Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films. Ben Flanagan of AL.com.
Hello, Ben. How are you?
Good Saturday morning, Ben.
So, we both saw Dunkirk on opening day. This is a new movie by Christopher Nolan. Usually I would kind of set it up and kind of pitch it to you. But I will go ahead and just start off and say that we'll probably cover some spoilers here. But just right out of the gate, I think this is an amazing movie that is something that just blew me away is that this is a movie about horizons, like from the opening, from the logo of the movie even. This is a movie about human beings staring at a horizon, running towards a horizon in the opening shot, hoping for some sort of deliverance. And then in the end, there's a line in the movie that summed it all up where these soldiers are feeling shame for being rescued, you know, and having to be evacuated and basically being lifted from the fight rather than fighting. It is juxtaposed with a line from Winston Churchill that reads, "Deliverance is also victory." So this movie from beginning to end has a thematic strength and through line that is right up my alley and just totally just works for me. And it's been a long time since I've, maybe not a long time, but it's been a while because there's tons of great movies in the theaters all the time. But it's really been a while since a movie has affected me in such a way. Maybe The Master in 2012 or Inside Out in 2015 that affected me this way, where it struck a nerve somewhere inside, and I can't quite put my finger on it, but I will say all that to say one of the most exciting thoughts I had when I came out of theater was I can't wait to talk about this movie with one of the film nerds. So all that to say, thank you for getting on the phone with me and talking about this movie. I hope you had close to the experience that I had with it. So all that out of the way, what are your thoughts on Dunkirk?
Well, I think it's really wonderful that it's barely 10 a.m. on Friday morning and we've already seen the new Christopher Nolan movie, both of us seeing it the Thursday night before it came out. On your birthday, no less.
Yeah, so we got good wives. Yeah. Our wives are very good to us, aren't they?
Yeah. I'm pretty much with you, I think, and you and I are big fans of Nolan, and from what's interesting about this movie is and what's interesting about Nolan's career is that he's always gotten a lot of flack, if there's been flack to give Nolan for not being a really personal filmmaker, not a very emotion, he doesn't really tell stories with a lot of emotion. I happen to disagree with that, but I mean, I think from a very early point in this film's marketing, you got the impression that this was a very personal film for Nolan, even on the level of Interstellar, which he finally came through to those, not that he had to or he had anything to prove, but sort of proving those naysayers wrong. Interstellar is as an emotional film experience as you'll find. And I think with Dunkirk, it's even more apparent when you see it, how personal it is down to the final moments, which are, for me, as inspired as anything that Nolan has ever done. And I think, you know, what you're right in terms of the horizons theme and idea that this movie explores, but I mean, there's just so much going on here in terms of what these men, the just crisis that these men and women, in fact, in one specific instance in this film, what they're going through and what all they're having to come to terms with in the immediate just horror of the evacuation of Dunkirk, the fact that this movie deals with, through the eyes of all of these people, survival, you mentioned hope and hopelessness, resilience and fear and bravery from really all corners in anybody who had a hand in this evacuation, no matter how old they were. They could have been very old, they could have been soldier age. They could have been very young, obviously, as the case is with some characters in this movie. But I think it explores the definition of what bravery is. And that line that you mentioned, the Churchill line, really touches on that. There's a moment towards the end of the movie where the soldiers have been evacuated, some of them anyway, obviously, and they're passing civilians who are handing them food and handing them towels and greeting them as they come back, and they're being warmly received by people, when one character, and I'm sure many, felt that they would be ostracized for cowardice and the fact that they had to be saved. And you see this old man handing out blankets saying, "Well done, lads, well done." And one of the characters turns to him and says, "All we did was survive." And the man says something like, "Well, that's enough. You know, mm-hmm. survival is enough." And survival in many cases is bravery. And, you know, people might have different definitions and different interpretations of bravery. And obviously cowardice, as the soldiers themselves expressed that, in terms of having to flee an impossible situation in what Churchill coined as a military disaster. And the way Nolan realizes it just speaks to how important this story is for not only Brits in their history, but also the French, and I'm sure in some cases the Germans, who are an unseen force in this movie for the most part. It's just a really amazing and horrifying piece of history that obviously means a lot to this filmmaker. And I don't think we have to stress just how technically marvelous Nolan's movies are, and Dunkirk is just at the top of the heap. Just Nolan, he might pull greatness from whichever cinematographer he chooses on a given project, but Hoyt Van Hoytma's work here is pretty mesmerizing, particularly mm-hmm. the aerial sequences, but really from the opening shot. It's just so beautifully realized, and you're talking about set pieces and really just the entire movie that's realized from three different perspectives, from air, land, and sea. And it's just so ambitious, and we should expect no less from Nolan. And he just surrounds himself with such brilliant people, you know, including the cast. And yeah, I'm with you. Like, I mean, it really hits you hard. It hits you fast. But by the end of it, you just know you've been through something, and it's one of Nolan's best.
Yeah, there's a moment like 10 minutes in, and it's something I'm working on for myself. I've got like social media overload on the brain, so much so that like the first 10 minutes of movies, I'm often having this stupid invisible argument with myself about, I don't really like that, or, you know, this or that, or, hey, I bet this will be a problem that I, you know, cite to myself later on. And what is my Letterboxd rating going to be? And all of that crap is floating around my head so often these days. I'm trying to, you know, I've done a Twitter purge and a Facebook purge, and I'm trying to make sure I'm shifting the way I think about movies. But you know, there was a point, you know, between 10 and 20 minutes into this movie where I was a bit confused. And I was like, wait, so if this is happening there, it's nighttime there, I don't get it. Like, is this just messy filmmaking? Is this just... And then, like, it was like Jiminy Cricket, you know, was like, hey, shut up, calm down. You're in a Christopher Nolan movie. I promise you at the end of this, it will all add up and you will make sense. You will be able to make sense of this. And sure enough, you know, it occurred to me, like, oh, right, like, the mathematical construction of this, you know, where the air portion of the movie takes place over an hour, the sea portion takes place over a day, and then the land portion takes place over a week, which is blatantly expressed at the beginning of the movie. But that really kind of came to light, and that's when the movie really started working for me, and then you kind of get these Rashomon-esque perspective changes, you know, where you see an event happen two or three times from different perspectives, and you see how these people make differences in each other's lives without ever, you know, having a word exchanged between them. And it's just, it all adds up to this this really great, purely visual, I mean, in many ways, purely visual, or at least purely cinematic in terms of the combination of visuals and audio. I mean, I really think there's only one scene of kind of exposition, you know, where these three officers get together and talk about the situation, and one of our main characters kind of overhears it. That's like the closest thing you get to a expository scene in this movie, and the rest is very, it's very visual, it's very tactile. A big influence clearly is Robert Bresson, who made movies like A Man Escaped, which is all about these this detail-driven process of escaping a prison, and it's all equally mesmerizing. So yeah, there's so much craft and that goes into that went into the structure of this movie, but also the performances and the technical aspects of it. But it's like you said, it's not that. It's not just a cold exercise. This is also a extremely emotional movie about human beings and how we interact and how we survive and what the yearning for survival does to us. This is a movie that makes so many great cases with these little character moments. One of them being that weakness isn't cowardice. You know, like you can be weak and be courageous at the same time. There's this really wonderful young boy or, you know, young man, 17-year-old kid in this movie that really brings very little to the fight, but his courage is still counted. You know, they still count his courage. And, there's just a lot of really beautiful things, but then there's, on the other hand, there's the cowardly, shell-shocked officer that accidentally kills the boy who is not shamed. You know, the Mark Rylance character says, you know, he's not himself. This is just in a strange way, a very tender and human movie about basically, hey, we're all in this together, and so, you know, let's get to where we're going together.
Yeah, what a haunting moment when Mark Rylance tells his son that he's not himself and he may never be himself again.
Yeah.
And any time you see the Cillian Murphy character, I mean, that is so just thoroughly realized. And, like, it's a really wonderful performance. It's a really, like, amazingly drawn out character, even when he says and does very little, you can just look at him and realize like his life has just been destroyed, you know,
yeah.
in one way or another. So yeah, you know, it's just crazy how many different perspectives and the way that he uses an ensemble here. And you mentioned the lead character, there's several, and it's just the performances are so good. And, you know, I hope that this movie's sort of opening, and really it lasts for most of the movie itself, but I hope that this opening is praised in a similar way to how the sort of first 15 to 20 minutes of There Will Be Blood were praised for its silence, you know, and there's very little dialogue in this movie. And when there is, it really counts, but it's just such a unique studio movie moment where it opens with this striking image of this deserted war-torn town. And then from that point on, for a pretty decent chunk, you barely hear anybody speak to anybody, and you're just seeing physicality, you're seeing the actions of people, you're seeing the intensity of war. Nothing needs to be said. I mean, you really understand it as soon as, you know, you understand it from the jump. And, you know, you mentioned sort of the format of this movie, the structure of it, and how Christopher Nolan just... The guy just almost doesn't get enough credit for this. And I know that that's sort of the defining characteristic of who he is as a filmmaker, but he just sort of keeps raising the bar for this sort of experimentation with nonlinear storytelling that in the way that the guy plays with time. Like, I don't know if Christopher Nolan is much of a podcast listener, but man, I hope he checks out S-Town, because I think that he and John B. McLemore probably have a lot in common just in terms of their obsession with time and their obsession with sort of the clock, the manifestation of time in our lives and how he can utilize that in terms of storytelling, because time is so consequential when it comes to storytelling and filmmaking, because, I mean, it's a finite experience, and, like, we're only there for... You know, obviously in life too, but we're only there for a given amount of time. And so he really understands how to utilize it in such unique ways, and utilizing utilizing it for people's perspectives and taking full advantage in of things that we haven't really thought about. I thought he did it, obviously, with in terms of the nonlinear structure, as soon as Memento, obviously, which put him on the map in terms of how he told that story. He did the same, I think, with Inception. Clearly, there's so much going on there in terms of expanding time, how minutes become hours, hours become days, days become years in terms of the different levels of dreams people find themselves in. He did it again with Interstellar, where once again you have this insane sort of time conversion that just creates these amazing consequences for these characters and raises the stakes in such an unbelievable way. But you're right, like when that first title comes up that says The Mole, 1 week, I just immediately thought, oh God, this feels like a test. Like, what do I do here? Like, what does this mean? What does it mean? And then, you know, we get the next two titles, and I was just thinking, like, oh God, yeah, it does feel like a math quiz, and I wasn't prepared to do my homework. And
Yeah,
but then it all starts to coalesce, you know, like it all starts to come together, and it all kind of like meets at once. And there are certain little beats where you see characters in different layers of the story, and you think, okay, now it makes sense. And everything's that much more awesome now. But when it all just meets in the middle, this movie is just on another level.
Well, it's like this weird like pride thing for me, where I feel like I'm behind, and I feel stupid, and you know, and it's like I'm behind the narrative, and I feel like I should be ahead of the narrative, and that's because that's what we're used to, you know? We're used to being in movies and, you know, kind of being like, okay, and then this is going to happen. Okay, cool, I'm glad that happened that way. Or I'm not happy that happened that way. But in this movie, it's like, I felt behind the whole time, and I felt like a dummy. And it's like, well, that's on me, you know? Because eventually, I was fine, you know? Everything caught up to itself in a way, and everything was made clear. I was just reading this interview with David Mamet yesterday, and he was talking about that's good writing, that, you know, the audience should be asking what happens next, but also the audience should be asking what's happening right now, so that, you know, when they figure it out, they'll be with the characters, you know, and it's just this play on perspective that really increases the stress of a movie going experience. And increases the humility, and you really have to kind of give yourself up to the material that you're watching. But at the end of the day, it's so much more active and engaging and edifying in a lot of ways. So, saying it was like a math quiz was that's pretty accurate. Obviously, yeah, there's a ton of go ahead.
I was going to say a lot of credit goes to Lee Smith, his editor.
Yes.
Who. Yeah. You know, I was reminded a lot of Inception as I was watching it, and I was trying to sort of piece together the layers, and all I could keep thinking about was how they kept cutting back to the vans, you know, falling off of the bridge into the river, into the water or whatever. And so these two movies, outside of just, you know, being Christopher Nolan movies, are kind of kindred spirits in that regard, because again, you're right, like it ups the tension and your stress as you're watching it, because you keep being reminded of that timeline and like where we are, and you keep it puts you on the edge of your seat in terms of like, okay, well, what's going to happen here? How is one thing leading to the other? Oh, I forgot about this. I forgot about this part of the timeline. That's really important. What's going to happen? So these two are just a really amazing match.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's like two halves to his career, you know, right now. I think from Following to through the Batman trilogy, I feel like the central statement or question of Nolan's movies is, who am I? You know, they're so much about identity and, you know, relating to other people and figuring out, you know, what constitutes my identity. And then from Inception to Dunkirk, the theme is basically time sucks. You know, like, time is the great villain in both in Inception and Interstellar, and now in its own way, Dunkirk. And yeah, it's definitely a preoccupation of his now, which is great. And yeah, I mean, going back to what you were saying earlier, like, this is a $150 million blockbuster where this film artist is working out his kinks you know, and working out his quirks and working out his trying new things and trying to press the medium. And whether that works for everybody, I can't say. That's not for even Christopher Nolan to determine. But, you know, it's still, it's, I mean, I guess the big question for this movie that we could maybe wrap up on is Dunkirk the first experimental summer blockbuster? You know, I can't think of, in terms of like, sure, there's Jurassic Park, which, you know, broke ground, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, taking any chances structurally, you know, or in terms of editing or anything like that. I feel like that's kind of how Nolan might pitch this movie. Do you see it as such?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think you could even go back to 2015, where you had a couple of summer blockbusters that were relatively unconventional, especially Mad Max Fury Road, which, you know, had some of the look of a big summer blockbuster in that there were big car chases. It was big, bright, and colorful. But there's a lot about that movie that I don't think a lot of mainstream moviegoers are totally used to, you know, especially coming from a guy like George Miller. So I think you can say that. I think even Pixar sort of outdoes itself in terms of its chances that it takes. And I think Inside Out was another one where it's like, wait a second, like this is a Disney movie. This is Pixar. This movie's making me think on a level that I never expected anything to, let alone like an animated Disney cartoon, you know, like, so it's great that there are studios out there that are willing to take chances, but they obviously have to inherently trust filmmakers like Christopher Nolan to do that. And then you can go back to Inception, where, I mean, looking back, it seems like a total no-brainer, in that you hand the keys to this guy who made these Batman movies and let him do what he wants. But I mean, even writing a blank check for a movie like Inception, which was completely original and completely from Christopher Nolan's head, it's amazing. It's a miracle that happened. But I guess, I mean, with this being what, his 10th movie now, like he earned so much street cred, and he has such big ideas that he only feels comfortable enough to realize within the studio system. It's just amazing that he's been able to earn that credibility and that trust with the studio system, that they're willing to, again, write him blank checks for whatever ideas he has. So yeah, I think he is more unique than maybe any other filmmaker working within the studio system, but that people probably already knew that.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, kudos to Warner Brothers, you know, who gave us, in the span of 5 years, they gave us this movie and Gravity, which was possibly more expensive and similarly, you know, confined and in some ways experimental. It wasn't a summer movie, but, you know, you mentioned There Will Be Blood earlier, not Inside Out, but I was thinking WALL-E in terms of that first 20 minutes being entirely visual. But yeah, also I would cite Gravity too as this kind of like stripped down survival movie using the tip-top, you know, state-of-the-art technology and cinema to bring it home, with a final moment that just, like, really floors you and just brings you back to, you know, you've got all these moving parts, all this money at play, all this expensive stuff, but it all comes down to a human moment and the relationship between people and their surroundings. And I think that, like Gravity, like Kubrick movies in some cases, like Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master and Pixar movies, I think that Christopher Nolan just takes this massive, expensive palette of colors and tools and brushes and creates something that you just can't get in any other art form.
No, that's true. He is really is a brand unto himself. And you mentioned the ending. It's amazing. It's sort of a similarly built sort of swelling little montage that we got in Interstellar, which is also really good here, the way it ends on a very different note. And I want to ask you about that in a second, but the final bits we see from Tom Hardy are some of the coolest things I've ever seen on a movie screen. And in what perfect casting Tom Hardy was there as the Spitfire pilot in this movie. I mean, wow. Like I was just like, That was like jaw-dropping stuff at the end of this movie involving his character. But what do you make of the very last shot of Dunkirk?
I would have to remember the final line that kind of because it's like the shot before it is, was it the helmets on the beach? And then I mean, it's the Churchill, we'll fight in the seas, we'll fight in the skies,
right,
and all that stuff. And
so
then,
basically, this character is reading the Winston Churchill speech from the newspaper. And we get this big, again, sweeping, swelling montage.
Seeing
the aftermath.
Which is kind of his thing. I mean, that's the thing, is that if we were assholes, we could do a parody of this, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Totally,
like I said,
reduce
he did it in the
down
last movie. And he,
yeah, well, he
yeah,
did
he
it
did
in Inception and in The Dark Knight as well. Yeah, it's
For sure.
And that's fine.
And Dark Knight Rises, for that matter. But
But
those movies didn't have this last little moment here.
Right, yeah. Then it cuts back to a character's face in close-up. And he kind of looks up at the other character.
And he has a very, like, interesting look on his face. And it just cuts to black. Like, the movie takes one final breath. Like, do you think that what is Nolan saying there? Like, what is his response to that speech? What is that character's response to that speech? Because the look on his face is kind of like the look that we've seen the entire movie, where it's kind of blank.
I think it's shame. I think that this is a character who, you get this, like you said, this swelling thing where he's talking about victory, but we're seeing a POW being captured, you know, Tom Hardy. We're seeing helmets left on the beach. We're seeing this deserted area, and then we see this guy that the entire movie has been running away, and one of his biggest acts in the movie is deserting his friend that saved his life, you know, to drown in that ship. So I think that he's a winner. You know, I think that that's kind of what the movie is saying, is that, look, well, you know, that by no act of his own, he won. He was carried to salvation by, you know, an army of other people, of civilians and enlisted people, and now he's safe. And, like, what do you do with that? You know, what do you do with all you want to do is survive at any cost, even to the point of abandoning other people, and you get it. Like, what's the next step? So I think it's a difficult beat. I think it's a difficult beat to land on, but I think also there's a nice symmetry because it's also – the first person we see in the movie, you know, we see the back of him running away from camera in the opening shot. And then we end with a close up of him kind of looking off camera at another character who's, you know, you could call him worse, you know, in terms of the way he embraced his survivalist mentality. So I don't know. I don't think there's an easy answer there, but I think that was kind of what I took away. It was just this kind of like note of shame and relief and the fact that that doesn't change anything, you know?
Yeah. He's got to live with it now, like the rest of his life, that whole experience and everything that everybody sacrificed for them. Those guys are safe and sound now. And that whole big sweeping montage and that amazing Churchill speech that is so idealistic and so gung-ho in terms of fighting the good fight. And then there's, like, the actual practical reality of it, these guys just lived through that, all that Churchill described, and maybe that's not – it's obviously not all that there is to it. There's the shell-shocked soldier. There are these guys who are having to come to grips with the fact that they're having to ask themselves, are we cowards? Are we brave? Did we do the right thing by surviving the way that we did? There are people that made the sacrifice who died. There are people like the Tom Hardy character who made the sacrifice, like who is like the absolute symbol of bravery in this fight, who end up losing.
He gives himself,
you know, like you said,
yeah,
like the
he gives himself
losers
to the other side so that these guys can live.
Yep, exactly. So it's, you know, like you said, it's challenging. It's just a really amazing moment, I think, that it's an amazing choice that Nolan made there. Because, again, I know how personal this story is, and he has family who fought in World War II, obviously on the British side. So this means a great deal to him, and Dunkirk obviously means a great deal to the British history as it relates to World War II. So, you know, it's good because war movies should be complicated. War stories should be complicated because, I mean, for people like us and, you know, Nolan too, we'll never know the true experience that these people went through and the horrors that they face. We may never see a war like that again. You know, hopefully we won't, and
God,
who knows
that,
if we will. And there are people who are seeing horrible things like this even in 2017, obviously in different parts of the world. So it's important that if we don't do that, we at least make an effort to see it through their eyes. And for a lot of people, they don't see the rah-rah, and they don't have that rah-rah sentimentality when it comes to the myths of these wars that people do create, and sort of like the propaganda machines that try to convince you that it was all good, and everything that was done was good and had good consequences. It's obviously not always true, and more often than not, it probably isn't, because there are people who actually have to go through this, and then they've got to live with it for the rest of their lives if they're lucky enough to survive.
Absolutely.
So it's complicated. And my last question for you, Stark, this is just kind of a general Nolan question. What do you think of Christopher Nolan's aversion to blood on screen?
I think, yeah, that's interesting because there's like, I'm always reminded of that. There's like a shot in The Dark Knight Rises of Matthew Modine, like, leading the charge of police officers, and then he gets gunned down by Marion Cotillard. And then it's just a shot of him, like, sleeping, like, on the floor. And, yeah, just like, wow, he should be covered in blood. I think it's just he knows to keep making his movies. He's playing in the PG-13 sandbox, and he needs to stick to that. And I think that you can't make an R-rated $150 million movie about a World War II defeat with IMAX cameras, you know, and all this other extremely laborious and just, he's a pain in the ass to the studio. You know, he is a massive pain in the ass to work with, I'm sure. And to do that, he's got to make sure that he can make the movie appeal to the broadest possible audience. And so I think he makes certain concessions, and I think that's one of them. We walked out of the movie theater, there was a 4-year-old kid down the road from us. There's some 7-year-olds. It was like, okay, well, they probably had a bad time, but that's okay. Maybe they learned something. I don't know. But, yeah, so I think it's that. I think it's just he knows he's a tentpole filmmaker, and tentpole filmmakers don't make R-rated movies. And so he has to – that's why there's not a whole lot of nudity. I think there were 2 F-words in this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, so he's willing to, you know, throw that in there. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's the one thing I can think of.
Yeah, shootings in Inception, shootings in his Batman movies, and they're totally bloodless. And I just think
Joker like cuts a guy's face off or, you know, neck or something like that, and there's just like nothing.
Right, and that's clearly a choice because, I mean, we know by now in 2017 how lenient the MPAA is in terms of violence as opposed to sex and even language. Like, violence sort of gets a pass, and you know, I'm guessing the larger the studio film is, the bigger it is and the more prestige it has, the more lenient they'll be in terms of giving the movies a pass and giving them, you know, more opportunities to make more money and grow their audience. So I think it's more so a choice on the part of Nolan, and maybe some of that goes into it, because, I mean, it's just been so apparent.
I think it's the blood. I think
everything
it's
that he's
the
done.
Blood. You can only have, like, there's probably, like, a, you know, an amount, some sort of metric to measure how much actual blood you can see on camera in a PG-13 movie. I mean, I just can't think of
any. Movies aren't particularly profane. I mean, they say the F-word in this movie. I believe Harry Styles says it both times in this movie, if I'm not mistaken, or at least as one of them, which is funny. But
that was an improv.
Yeah, but I mean, look, I mean, Memento is relatively profane, and Insomnia was rated R, but everything else since then has been PG-13, and has, you know, I'll go back to, I think that this is a choice that Nolan has made, because again, I think
I understand violence is one thing, but what are some actually bloody PG-13 movies?
Well, let me pull up the PG-13 Wikipedia page. Real quick.
That's a big Wikipedia page. Yeah, I just can't, like, you know, like, any Marvel movies don't have blood in them. I don't know. I just feel like that it's just the blood.
There's a little bit of blood in Marvel movies. I think more so than in...
Yeah, but there's not, like, gunshots, like, you know, like, squibs and stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think it's just a
gratuitous. I'm just saying.
You may have a
more noticeable in his movies than others.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I think also the reason it's more noticeable in his movies is that he doesn't cut away as much. Is that he'll just, like, oh, that person got shot? Well, guess what? I'm filming with a giant IMAX camera,
right,
and I'm going to use all this footage.
And they just
so if it doesn't
down.
Look, yeah, if it doesn't look quite real enough to you, I'm not going to put in digital blood later, so just eat it. You know, I don't know. That's one thing that really struck me in this movie is I feel like he's more and more getting a handle on steady, like, long, sustained, steady shots. And, again, the large format film has a lot to do with that, I'm sure, but you mentioned that Tom Hardy flying, gliding sequence at the end, there's a shot where he is fixed in the middle ground, and in the background you see Dunkirk, the city, just kind of flying by, you know, and it's all in this one big open frame. And that was one of the moments in the movie that just took my breath away. And I was like, this is the kind of shot that you can't get on a 35mm, you know, movie or, you know, or HD movie or whatever you call it. You know, it's just like the way that the lenses work, this works better that way. So
in his aerial photography it's been a big part of his filmmaking for a while now. I'm in the middle of rewatching Insomnia.
Oh yeah.
During the opening of Insomnia, like, there's this plane flying over glaciers and woods, and it's really beautiful. And then obviously in the opening sequence of The Dark Knight Rises, was just such an ambitious double plane sequence that that it seems like only Nolan is, like, I don't know if he's the only person that's really capable of doing this, but it seems like he's the only person interested in doing it and relying on the actual cameras and actual planes without so largely depending on CG, which we do see in a lot of other, like, aerial, like, quote unquote aerial photography in movies. So God bless Christopher Nolan for that too.
Yeah, absolutely. He's great.
So, I mean, there's been a lot of, I don't want to say hyperbole because I want to trust that people feel strongly about Dunkirk. That I mean, there are people out there calling it an all-timer right now. I'm not ready.
Ryan
I'm never
Johnson,
ready.
That was
yeah,
Ryan Johnson's.
Okay, so yeah, I'm never that ready to just fly into, okay, all-timer status. But, you know, I'm okay with jumping into sort of like ranking it among Christopher Nolan movies. Is this pretty high on the list of Christopher Nolan movies that all are pretty dang good?
It's pretty tough because, you know, like, Dark Knight is, like, in my top 10. So, you know, that's if I put it above that, then that's
really
costing
me something.
I'm not
asking if it's your
so,
I mean, yeah, okay,
but no,
I'm not asking if it's a top
3.
10 movie, but
it's
like,
probably
in terms
the top
of Chris,
3. Ooh. It's top 5 at least. Yeah, I would say at this point. But again, I got to sleep on it and see it again. Process. You know?
I think top 5 is pretty easy. Top 3, that we're getting into the discussion there. I mean, for me, I'm still all about The Prestige and Inception, and I love Interstellar, but, like, after that, we get into Dark Knight territory and Memento, and I think that Dunkirk fits snugly with all of those movies.
It's in the conversation for me with Dark Knight, Memento, and Inception, which are kind of at the top tiers, in the top tier for me.
All right, so Christopher Nolan made a good movie again.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.